keep photos on a computer with such an easily guessed password. There were fishing pictures, pictures of Buck on vacation on some island, maybe the Florida Keys, pictures of his boat, his truck, pictures of the previous year's Christmas were the oldest on the computer, pictures of everyone, lots of poorly lighted pictures, pictures of the floor, the ceiling, all spoke of someone learning how to use a new, unfamiliar camera. Looking around Pollard's low-tech house, sitting at his late 90s model Dell, Jack could believe Pollard had just transitioned to digital. He was bored. He typed M4V into the search field and hit enter. Four files showed up, all created within the last 2 months. Jack clicked on the most recent one and waited for the computer to open the movie program and load it. It took a while. His phone vibrated in his pocket. He pulled it out and saw that he missed a voicemail and a call from an unknown Dallas number. The computer was still working, so he swiped the message to open the voicemail. He guessed he would have to put his phone on ring, though he hated the sound no matter what the tone.
"Hey, Jack. It's me, Ellie. I'm calling from Liam's cell since I left mine at home this morning. I was distracted, spacey, though I can't imagine why."
Jack smiled. He heard the sarcasm in her voice clearly. He swiveled around in the chair and stared at Buck Pollard's queen bed. What an ugly quilt.
"I'm calling to let you know I left my cell at home, in case you try and can't get in touch with me. I didn't want you to worry. Not that you would. Worry. Or try to get in touch with me, I mean. You know I'm out of town, but... oh, God, I'm rambling. I tend to do that on voicemail, which is why I don't leave them. Anyway, why I called. I'm going to text you directions to my lake house. I didn't give them to you this morning."
She paused. In his mind's eye, Jack saw her chewing her lip.
"That's not really why I called. I called to tell you I miss you. Stupid, since I just saw you and we'll see you in a few hours. It's different, not being in the same town. Oh, God, I sound like an idiot. Talk about sappy. I should have stopped this message ages ago. I'll see you tonight. Ignore this message. Bye."
Jack shook his head with a smile and stared at the phone. Affection surged through him at the sound of her embarrassed, unsure voice. A small part of him had worried that she was much more lackadaisical about their relationship, that he was the one who felt more, wanted more, expected more. He wasn't sure about the last two. Only time would tell with those, but he believed she felt as much as he did. He was amazed at how much better he felt just by hearing Ellie's voice. God, she was extraordinary. Why couldn't he have met her when they were younger? They would have been that kick-ass couple everyone envied. Fulfilling careers, beautiful children, strong relationship. They would be looking forward to when the kids left and what they would do, where they would live, the exotic places they would travel. Sure, they would fight. Everyone fights. But it wouldn't be the over-emotional, narcissistic bullshit he'd had with Julie. Ellie would lay it out on the table. No double meanings, manipulation, or sudden rages. They would talk, yell, be silent, reconcile, and try to remember later what the fuss had been about. At least, that was what he had been told happened within a healthy relationship. He didn't know firsthand, but he would know, and soon. He was determined to do whatever it took to make it work with Ellie. Tomorrow morning he would meet with Bob Underwood and there would be nothing to keep them from seeing each other. Ethan would come around when he got to know her. Jack felt sure that deep down Ethan realized his mother had problems. He had lived in the same house, after all. Jack clapped his hands together. He was invigorated, the way he was when he drank 3 cups of extra strong coffee. A bit jittery, maybe, anxious to get going and do something, anything, to make the day move faster. His watch said there were 6 hours until he would see her. That was a bit of a buzzkill, but he'd sat in a surveillance van in 100-degree heat with a gaseous agent for 12 hours before. Getting through the next six would be a piece of cake in comparison. Jack swiveled back around to face the computer. All thoughts of Ellie vanished. Jack stopped the video.
Miner? Ann, come here!
They walked down the hall, their footsteps hollow on the raised floor of the house. From the doorway, Ann called for one of her deputies to get a couple of boxes from the car. Miner walked into the room last.
Find something? Ann asked.
Yeah.
Jack restarted the video and stood so they could all see. The back of Jack's throat constricted, and a sour, metallic taste filled his mouth. Ann's breath caught, and she swore under her breath. Miner walked out of the room. Reluctantly, Jack moved forward and turned the sound on. Miner returned. It was a young Hispanic girl, no more than 11, sitting on a small, thin bed built into a wall. Her eyes were resigned. She'd done this before.
It's a boat, Ann said. See the porthole?
Jack nodded.
Miner, is Buck's boat that big?
Huh?
Miner sounded distracted.
Don't know.
Maybe.
He walked out of the room again. Two people talked off camera. One voice, female and heavily accented. The other, Buck Pollard's.
You want pictures? 4 hours, double price.
That wasn't the deal.
No pictures all night. Same price.
Why the change?
You take pictures and sell them. Make money. We get no cut of that.
I don't sell the pictures.
Then why take them?
I'm not paying double.
Then no pictures.
The woman spoke in Spanish to the girl.
Show him.
The girl started to remove her clothes. When she was naked, Buck said, his voice hoarse,
No pictures. Just get out.
Ann moved forward.
Turn it off.
She fumbled for the monitor power button and pushed it. With a click and a horizontal flash, the monitor died. Ann waved the deputy carrying boxes out of the room. He had to walk around Miner, who hovered in the door, staring at the floor, deep in thought.
Miner, care to join us?
Her voice was laced with irritation and anger. Jack knew it was more to do with what she had just seen than with Miner. Miner walked forward, still staring at the floor.
That son of a bitch, Ann said.
Miner's eyes were vacant, his mind somewhere else.
What is it, Miner?
Jack said.
I think I know where Buck hid his stuff.
Where?
Jack and Ann asked in unison. Miner pounded his boot on the floor, turned and walked into the hall. He pounded his foot again.
Son of a bitch,
Ann repeated.
Under the house, Jack said.
Miner nodded.
Is that in the scope of the warrant?
Jack said. Ann took out her cell phone.
I'll double check.
She patted Miner on the shoulder as she went past. Jack walked up to Miner and looked his deputy in the eyes. Unlike the first day at the Ramos's, Miner's eyes met him steadily. Jack held his hand out. Miner gripped it, shook it once.
I would have figured it out eventually,
Jack said, barely hiding his smile.
Uh-huh.
You have been wrong about one thing. Jack's phone vibrated in his pocket.
What's that?
He removed his phone and looked at the screen before answering. His heart stopped. Julie's smiling face looked back at him. Was Ethan calling from his mother's phone? Or was Eddie trying to freak him out?
What's that?
Miner repeated.
What?
Jack looked up.
What was I wrong about? Oh, you would have made a great chief.
Jack walked a little away and accepted the call.
Ethan, why are you using your mother's phone?
Jack?
The voice was high-pitched and girlish for a 40-year-old woman. It was familiar and alien at the same time. The ground started to spin. Jack put his hand on the wall to steady himself.
It's me. I'm home.
4. Jack burst through the front door of his house, telling himself he was wrong. He hadn't just gotten a phone call from his wife. She was gone, would stay gone until tomorrow when he filed for divorce. This wasn't happening. It was his mind playing tricks on him. There she was, sitting at the desk next to Ethan, beaming, standing up and coming toward him, wrapping her arms around his waist, hugging him, resting her head on his chest where she had rested it thousands of times before. Her hair smelled the same, looked a bit lighter than usual, to be expected when you spend a year on the beach. Ethan sat at the desk, beaming. Why was he smiling? Why wasn't he furious?
Oh my God, Jack, Julie squeezed him. I've missed you so much.
Behind Ethan, the computer screen was full of a picture of the bank. Downtown, across from Ellie's store. The next picture in the slideshow would be Ellie, walking onto her balcony, sitting down, sipping coffee, discarding her book, the mischievous smile he loved. But instead he saw an old house, a road filled with potholes, two black men sitting on a porch smoking cigarettes. Relief rushed through Jack. Ethan had followed through on his threat. The pictures of Ellie were gone.
Ethan was just showing me pictures of this lovely town.
Julie's voice was muffled, but he heard the sarcasm. He put his hands on Julie's shoulders and pushed her away from him. She kept her arms around his waist and looked up. Her smile now was ironic, challenging him to lash out at her in front of Ethan. Her back was to their son, so he didn't get to see the subtle change in her demeanor.
Why do you look so surprised? Didn't you get my email?
No.
I sent it days ago. Maybe it went into your spam folder.
You should have called. She laughed.
I should have written down your and Ethan's phone numbers before I left. You know, I haven't memorized a number since cell phones. And since we agreed I would leave my phone with you.
She let the sentence dangle to see if he would challenge her. Ethan still smiled, though Jack thought he detected a sliver of doubt. He hoped he did.
Your parents could have relayed the message.
Or you could check your spam folder occasionally.
Her laugh was forced and fake. How could Ethan not see through her? Julie put her hand on his cheek.
Oh, you look just terrible, honey. How do you feel?
Jack stepped back. Fine.
Ethan, where's Eddie?
Ethan said Eddie is living here.
Julie's lip curled.
He can leave now.
Eddie can stay as long as he wants.
He said he was going to get stuff for hamburgers hours ago,
Ethan replied.
Ethan, could you give us a few minutes?
Jack said.
I want
Ethan.
Julie went over to Ethan and ran her hand through his hair.
Go on, sweetie. I'm not going anywhere.
Ethan left the office reluctantly. Jack watched him go up the stairs, heard the creak of his door. When he heard it close, he looked at Julie. She was amused.
What the hell, Jack? A police chief?
What are you doing here, Julie?
What do you mean? I'm home.
This isn't your home.
Wherever you and Ethan are is my home. Though I do wonder what you did with the house in Emerson. We're both on the mortgage.
I'm renting it out. Why are you back?
Ethan emailed me last week. He begged me to come home. Here I am.
He's been begging you to come home for a year. Why now?
Obviously, you need me.
Actually, you are the last thing I need.
What did you tell him about where you've been?
I told him the truth.
Oh, really? About California?
She didn't look embarrassed.
You know where I was, and never came for me.
I came, saw you with whatever man you were fucking that month, and left. What did you tell Ethan?
I told him I was on a sabbatical that you approved of from the beginning.
What a load.
And that I did it because of a book deal I had about a stay-at-home mom and her journey to rediscover the woman she was before her life was subsumed by her husband and his career. My agent thinks it's going to be huge.
You're so full of shit.
Am I?
So, Ethan thinks I've been lying to him all this time, that I went along with your sabbatical but didn't bother to tell him? Why am I not surprised? You're here for an hour, and already I'm the bad guy.
I didn't turn you into the bad guy. What lies have you told?
She narrowed her eyes. She was checking his story against Ethan's. He wondered what Ethan told her. Had he mentioned Ellie, his fight at school and suspension, the field trip incident in Emerson?
I told him you were taking time for yourself, that we needed a break.
Close enough. He's so happy he won't think too hard about the details.
Her face softened.
I really did miss you, Jack.
She moved to hug him again. He put his hands out to stop her. Don't. She nodded.
I understand. It's going to take time. But I'm committed to putting our marriage back together. I'm at a much better place now. I understand myself and you better than I ever have.
She ran her finger along the edge of the desk and kept her eyes down.
Being away from you made me realize how much I love you, how you're the only man I have ever truly loved.
When she brought her eyes back to his, they were filled with unshed tears.
God, she was good. But it wouldn't work anymore. Not on him. We'll talk later.
He turned to leave.
When will you be home?
We are down to 3 officers and I'm working 2 major cases. It will be late, well after midnight. Don't wait up.
He left, letting the screen door slap shut behind him. 5. Jack stopped short at the door of his office. For a split second, he thought someone had ransacked the place. Then he remembered his temper tantrum from the day before, and the broken drawer and office supplies strewn on the floor made more sense. Susan's organization compulsion didn't extend to his office. At least, not anymore. He knew he should talk to her about Ethan and Troy's fight, but with everything else going on, he didn't have the energy for it. He had no doubt that her coolness toward him since then was rooted in something deeper, but he didn't have the space in his mind for Susan Grant and her issues at the moment. He fell into his desk chair and stared out the window at the river. Of course Julie would come back on the 364th day, the day before he instigated the divorce. He should have done it sooner. At first he had expected her to return and they would work it out. When the rage reared its head, Jack was too busy wallowing in it to think clearly, to map out a long-term plan. Once the anger had retreated to a low simmer, he and Ethan embarked on their road trip. The job in Stillwater came up. They moved. Then Ellie. If he hadn't been so distracted by life, he would have had divorce papers drawn up, signed, and ready to present to Julie the moment she returned. He didn't. And he only had himself to blame. He rubbed his hands over his face. Ellie. What was he going to tell her? How was he going to tell her? Their relationship was too new, and she was still too unsure of him. He could sense it. Despite her passion and eagerness, there was always a reticence lurking behind her eyes. Was it fear? Fear that what they had was too good to be true? He had wondered the very thing himself over the past few days. No, it was true. Of that he was sure. But apparently their road to happiness was going to be full of potholes, detours, road closings, and possibly a blown bridge or two. Or was it distrust he saw in her eyes? She said flat out she wanted to trust him, the clear implication being the jury was still out and would remain so until he proved himself. That he was being punished, distrusted because of the sins of past men, rankled Jack a bit. Jack didn't believe for a moment Ellie would betray him like Julie had. They were nothing alike. Why couldn't Ellie trust Jack like he trusted her? The answer lay in the calendar on his desk blotter. 1 week. It was 1 week ago exactly that he started his job, that he met her at the bank, since Diego Vasquez escaped and sent Jack to the hospital. 7 days. Had it really only been that long? Ethan had emailed his mother that night, Jack assumed. Why did it take Julie a week to make her way to Stillwater? Where was she? Who was she with? If she'd come back earlier, Jack wouldn't have started the relationship with Ellie, which would save Ellie the emotional turmoil that was to come in, he looked at his watch, 4 hours. Jack pulled the metal trash can from beneath his desk and started cleaning up the destroyed drawer and its contents. The answer was staying busy and keeping his mind off his personal problems. It would work out. Of that he was sure. He would make damn well sure it would work out. Right now he needed to work on a schedule incorporating the sheriff's deputies and write up the reports on the Dodsworth case and the Ramos case, though questions still lingered about both. The exact truth of what happened between Claire, Elizabeth, and George Dodsworth would never be known. There was no one left alive to tell. Most likely it was a crime of passion. 50 years ago, Claire had returned to Stillwater to reclaim her family, ignorant of Elizabeth Pope taking her place, and had died in the process. Jack sat back on his heels. A wife returning after abandoning her family to find her husband happy with another woman. He couldn't ignore the parallels with his life. He only felt stupid it had taken him this long to see them. Lord knows, a few months ago, Jack's rage was sufficient to harm someone, though to kill Julie? Never. A cold fear seeped into his blood at the very idea. He knew from nearly 20 years in law enforcement that anyone was capable of murder. He pushed away the knowledge of the destruction in his life that such an act would lead to. The only person who might be able to say exactly what happened that night was Buck Pollard. He knew Claire Dodsworth had been killed by a knife at a point in the investigation when only Jack and Hugh Barnes knew it. Buck's mention of a knife was a slip, one Jack didn't think Buck realized even now. He had been too busy showing Jack his omniscience. Jack felt sure Pollard had gone to the Dodsworths when he learned Claire was back in town. Did he see the murder? Or did he come upon Elizabeth and George disposing of the body? Maybe he helped. Whatever Pollard's role, George Dodsworth did whatever he could for the rest of his life, including giving his daughter to Buck as a sexual object to keep him silent. Pollard must have realized then that harboring other people's secrets was the best way to consolidate and wield power. Again, it was all supposition, and it drove Jack crazy not knowing for sure. Pollard couldn't stay away forever. Jack would find out the truth if it was the last thing he did as police chief. Jack threw the front of the busted drawer into the metal trash can. The report he would write for this case would be a joke, either full of supposition and guessing or so spare with the confirmed facts as to be a report in name only. Hopefully it would give Barbara Dodsworth some sense of closure, though he doubted it. Her parents' betrayal haunted her. Buck Pollard haunted her. After seeing the grainy video of Pollard and that little girl, Jack was determined to bring him to justice. Watching Buck Pollard be ruined, his good name dragged through the mud, would be the salve to Barbara Dodsworth's ruined life. Though Jack knew Pollard ordered Freeman to kill the Ramoses, none of it would end up in the report, due in part to his own stupidity. It was irritating that the Ramos report, too, would be full of half-truths and lies, but the public didn't care. They wanted to know there wasn't a killer running around their sleepy little town, and if Jack was completely honest with himself, he needed to close both cases to burnish his reputation. He also needed to set up a meeting with the newspaper, try to kiss a little Fourth Estate ass to keep the town on his side until he could steady his sinking department. Buck Pollard's complicity in the deaths of three people would be swept under the rug. For now. Jack sat at his desk and typed up a quick press release to give to the Stillwater Gazette. For immediate release. Mike Freeman, 28, hanged himself in the Stillwater City Hall holding cell on Wednesday, September 19, after being charged with the murders of Gilberto and Rosa Ramos. The couple were found shot in their home on Thursday, September 6. In a taped and signed confession, Freeman admitted to murdering the Ramoses for drug-related reasons. A 50-year-old skeleton found on Barbara Dodsworth's land on Saturday, September 8, has been tentatively identified as Miss Dodsworth's biological mother, Claire Dodsworth. Because of the length of time since the death, as well as the passing of persons who may have knowledge of the events leading to Mrs. Dodsworth's death, specifics of what happened to Claire Dodsworth may never be known. Jack printed the amateur press release and placed it on the corner of the desk. He supposed he needed to add learning how to deal with local press to his to-do list. He rubbed his forehead. It gave him a headache just thinking about it. He knelt back under the desk to finish cleaning up the paperclips, thumbtacks, and trash he missed before, when he saw it. Crammed against the back of the desk, where the drawer would have been, was what looked like a yellowed plastic wallet insert. That's why it wouldn't close. He sat in his chair and reached under the desk. His phone beeped.
Chief McBride, you have a visitor.
The chill in Susan's voice was unmistakable.
Who?
He stopped and listened.
Esperanza Perez.
Send her back.
He knelt down and looked under the desk. He grasped the plastic, worked it back and forth, and gradually pulled it free.
Hola?
Jack tried to rise and banged his head on the underside of the desk. He crawled from under the desk.
Yep, I'm here.
He stood, placed the insert on the desk without looking at it.
Come in.
Esperanza held a small wooden box in her hands.
I brought you this.
She placed it on the desk.
What is that?
Rosas.
Where did you get it?
It's Carmen's. I picked it up when Josefina and I got Carmen's clothes and diapers. It has her birth certificate in it. That key fits it.
Esperanza turned to leave.
Where's Diego?
She shuddered, but didn't turn around.
I hope he's dead.
Jack walked around the desk and stood in front of her. She was pale and her lips were trembling.
I got the impression he was your friend.
Her eyes were mocking.
Men like Diego don't have friends. If you don't give them what they want, they take it. You better hope he's dead, too.
Why?
If he's not, your town would become a war zone.
It was a small cedar box, like one Jack had when he was a kid. He knew before he opened it with Rosa's key that Lane would be stamped on the inside lid. Gloved, Jack removed the paper and unfolded it. He sat down heavily in his chair, staring at a photocopied Polaroid. He pushed the box aside and lay the paper down next to the bent photo holder containing a picture of a young Buck Pollard in Vietnam and a yellowed, heavily creased newspaper article. He sat back and stared at the evidence and wondered what other secrets were hidden beneath Stillwater's crumbling facade. 6. Sitting in a threadbare brocade wing chair, Jane Maxwell looked diminished. Her hair was impeccable, her clothes crisp, but her pale, translucent skin and the dark circles under her eyes gave her away. She was old, dying. She stared at the newspaper clipping and copied Nazi family photo. Though her eyes lingered over the family photo, her face was a mask of indifference.
Yes, so?
Care to explain?
Explain what? I've never seen them before.
Really?
Jack pointed to Ingrid.
Is that you?
He looked from the picture to Jane to gauge her reaction. She was staring at him instead of the picture. He moved his finger to Jane Maxwell at 12 years old, wearing a Hitler Youth uniform.
Or is that you?
Jane didn't reply.
This, Jack said.
He pointed to the nurse, standing slightly behind a balding, bespectacled doctor in the newspaper picture. The caption placed it as Auschwitz.
Is you as well. You're older, but the resemblance is striking.
Jane's eyes were locked on Jack.
Where did you find these?
Jack tapped the newspaper article.
This was folded inside an old photo holder, which was crammed in the back of my desk drawer. The other was in the possession of a dead woman.
Jane's eyebrows rose.
A dead woman?
Rosa Ramos.
The Mexican who killed herself?
Jane asked, her voice full of incredulity.
So she didn't know about Rosa blackmailing Marta.
Rosa was murdered.
Not because of that, Jane said.
She flicked her hand at the coffee table.
Of course Jack knew that. Marta had motive, but lacked the physical ability or the mentality to carry out a double murder. That Jane could kill in cold blood, Jack had no doubt, but she had no motive. A murder would be too messy, public, and quick for the woman who was staring at Jack with shrewd, calculating eyes. Her revenge would be long, slow, painful, and private.
How long did you bribe Buck Pollard to stay silent about your past?
She laughed.
I didn't bribe Buck Pollard to stay silent.
Then why did he never make it public that you worked in a concentration camp?
Ask him.
You knew, though, right? That he knew you were a Nazi? That you were somehow involved in the extermination of Jews?
Everyone was involved, Mr. McBride. You couldn't live in Germany during that time and not be involved. The people who did nothing were as guilty as the people who herded them into the gas chambers.
How he found out isn't that hard to figure. What I wonder is why he looked in the first place.
You will have to ask him.
That's why you hate him so much.
If you say so. I must say, Mr. McBride, I'm not terribly impressed with your investigative skills. You come to me with nothing but two pieces of paper I've never seen before, with a lot of guessing and supposition. Are you just here to show me how smart you are? Is this what we can expect from the chief of police? Investigating ancient history while people die in your care? I wonder if you were the right man for this job.
You recruited me.
Hardly. You are recommended, though I don't know why.
By whom?
What is the point of you coming here? Are you accusing me of a crime, of murdering those two Mexicans?
No. Mike Freeman confessed to that.
Did he indeed? Well, that's very interesting. What was his motive?
Do you want the official story or the truth?
She raised one perfectly plucked eyebrow.
Both.
The truth is, Buck Pollard hired him to kill them. The official story is it was drug-related.
Are you sure the two stories are mutually exclusive?
Jack didn't reply.
How could she possibly know that?
Jane sighed.
I guess I have to do your job for you. Buck Pollard is a crime lord, for lack of a better term. a lofty name for a small-town country crime boss, but considering all the pies he has his fingers in, it's apt. Prostitution, drugs, and protection were his biggest rackets. Extortion, of course. That's why he resigned.
You aren't telling me anything I don't already know.
Oh, that's a relief.
The question is, how do you know?
Buck isn't the only person in town who has informants. The difference is I don't threaten the people who whisper in my ear with exposure of their weaknesses and peccadillos.
But you threatened Pollard and he resigned.
She nodded. He knows I don't make idle threats.
What did you threaten him with?
He's been putting money in offshore accounts for years. Much more than he made through the city or private security.
How do you know this?
I looked.
Pollard swears it isn't his account. He swears you established it to discredit him.
I had no idea he thought so highly of me.
Why didn't you turn that information over to the DA or the feds so he could be investigated?
My primary goal was to get him out of office. I didn't see the need to rub salt in his wound. I will happily turn the information over to you so you can start an investigation.
I'm surprised you trust me to do it.
Why do you think you're here, Mr. McBride?
Jane leaned forward and picked up the family picture.
This was Marta's?
Jane asked. Jack nodded.
I did not know she had it,
Jane said.
I told her when she came to me 45 years ago to throw everything from her past away. My sister had the bad luck to be in East Berlin when the Russians came,
Jane explained.
It took me years to discover she was alive. When I did, I worked to bring her here. It was my husband's last gift to me.
Jane placed the paper over the newspaper clipping.
Why have you shown this to me? Surely you can't think we had anything to do with the death of those two people.
Not directly, no, Jack replied. He pulled the Polaroid copy from his coat pocket and placed it on the table. Jane's eyes widened and her mouth turned down at the corners at the sight of the half-dressed young girl. Do you know this girl?
No.
Jack narrowed his eyes. What happened to your promise of complete honesty?
I don't like kids, never have. Why would I know who this girl is? Where did you get this picture?
Rosa Ramos had it.
Where did she get it?
Buck Pollard's house.
How do you know that?
Jack lifted the paper. On the back was a printout of an email from Pollard to a Galveston weather watcher about fishing conditions in the Gulf. Jack laid the paper down again and sat back in his chair. You aren't surprised.
What does this,
she said, motioning to the picture,
have to do with the other?
She waved at her family portrait. Rosa found your family picture in Marta's room. When Marta paid her to keep quiet so quickly and easily, Rosa decided it was an easy way to make money. When she cleaned Pollard's house, she either went snooping or maybe Pollard accidentally left this out. She made a copy on his printer, took it home, hid it, and was planning out what exactly she would ask Pollard for when she and her husband were killed on Pollard's orders. Jane shook her head, as if lamenting the loss of two innocent lives. But the small smile on her face spoke more of grudging admiration of Pollard's actions than disgust. You knew Pollard molested girls.
I heard rumors. I told him to take it outside of town, and he did.
Jack felt his face redden in anger. How can you possibly know that?
He gave me his word.
Jack's bark of laughter propelled him to stand. He walked to the fireplace and turned around. He gave you his word? A child molester told you he was going to stop, and you believed him. You don't strike me as an idiot, Jane, but maybe this is all just a well-rehearsed facade.
Buck Pollard is many, many things. A crook, a child molester, a cunning manipulator. but one thing he is not is a liar. When he gives his word, he sticks by it.
You sound like you admire him.
I loathe him, but that doesn't mean I don't have a certain amount of respect for him.
Loathe. Jack studied the woman in front of him and tried to reconcile that strong emotion with her implacable demeanor. He knew firsthand you couldn't feel hatred without first feeling its opposite. Jack opened his mouth to confront Jane about her past with Pollard when his phone buzzed. Anne Newberry's number popped up on the screen. He answered the phone, but his eyes didn't leave Jane.
Anne?
Just got a call from the Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard?
They just found Buck Pollard's boat drifting about 70 miles south-southwest of Galveston.
Did they arrest Pollard?
Looks like his boat capsized in the storm last night. There's no sign of him. He's just gone.
7. Ellie pulled into the drive of her lake house at 7:30 in the evening. The sun was lowering and a slight breeze rustled the leaves of the trees that bordered her house on three sides. The house was secluded, at the end of a long road with no other houses within sight. That would change soon. Across the lake, lots were being sold for development. Lake York had suddenly become popular with Dallas businessmen looking for a tax shelter. Ellie would have to decide soon if she wanted to keep the house or not. She pulled the paper bags from Eatsy's out of her back seat and walked to the door. The sounds of cicadas, frogs, and birds serenaded her on the way. The house was musty and hot. She kicked herself. There wouldn't be enough time for the AC to cool the house. Of course, who knew when Jack would arrive? It might be dark by the time he was able to get away. That was fine. They could sit on the back porch and drink wine. As she unpacked the bags, she made a mental note to get Barbara out here next week to give the house a good cleaning. She put the food in the oven, opened the bottle of wine, gave the furniture in the bedroom and living room a quick dust, and went into the bathroom to freshen up. The freedom she felt without her phone earlier in the day had now, 12 hours later, turned into a distraction. What if Jack couldn't come? There was no way for him to call her. She could have swung through town and picked her phone up, but she would have been seen, would have wanted to check in at the store, and then getting away would have been impossible. Coming straight here, having Jack meet her, meant no one would be the wiser about their affair. She wasn't ready to share it with the rest of Stillwater. Although they hadn't talked about it, Ellie felt sure Jack was keeping it under wraps as well. He had his divorce to think of. For her part, she kept it even from Kelly, which was no easy feat. There would be hell to pay in that quarter later if she found out Ellie lied to her. The one thing Kelly abhorred in friends was lying. Ellie checked herself in the mirror for the fifth time. She felt as nervous as she had been on her very first date, when she was 17 years old, with Joe Dan Weeks. She knew it was a pity date. She was as terrified the boy would try something as she was terrified he wouldn't. He took her up to the German church, was the first boy to feel her up, and never asked her out again. Other boys did after, but when none got farther than a handshake or peck on the cheek, everyone assumed Joe Dan had been telling lies again. Her reputation had been saved. She wished Joe Dan hadn't been so bad at feeling her up that she avoided it for so long after. It took meeting Jinx to understand what all the fuss was about. Of course, Jinx turned out to be a disaster as well. Things were different with Jack. For one thing, and right now the most important, the sex was amazing. There was no uncertainty or nervousness. Was it because she was mature enough and experienced enough to know what she wanted? Was it because she finally had sloughed off the guilt for wanting it or asking for it? Or was it because she had finally found the one person she fit perfectly with? Whatever. She didn't care. She only knew she found him and was going to fight like hell to keep him, to make it work. If that meant manipulating a teenager to like her or having to suffer through hanging around Eddie McBride, a man too similar to her ex-husband for comfort, she would do it with a big damn smile on her face. She heard a car. She flipped off the bathroom light and went to meet Jack. Ellie opened the door with a smile, hoping Jack couldn't hear her galloping heart. Her smile wavered when she saw him. His tread on the steps was heavy, his eyes downcast.
"Hey."
He looked up. The stress and despair on his face was shocking. He looked 10 years older than he had when he left her that morning. When his eyes met hers, his face cleared and broke into a relieved smile. Without a word, she went into his arms. He held her tightly, burying his face in her neck.
"Oh, God, I missed you," he said.
She didn't want to pull away. It felt too good to be held by him. It felt right, perfect, as if she had finally found the other half of herself that God had carved away when creating her.
"Did you have a bad day?"
"You have no idea."
She pulled slightly away so she could look at him.
"I just spent the last hour being interviewed by the Sentinel," he said.
"About Freeman?"
"And Pollard, and my brother, my personal life, and why I left the FBI."
He shook his head.
"As bad as it wasn't even the worst part of the day."
"I'm sorry," Ellie said.
He pushed a strand of hair behind her ear and smiled.
"I feel better now."
Ellie smiled and raised one eyebrow.
"You do?"
Jack looked her up and down.
"You clean up nice, Miss Martin. Purple is your color."
The compliment made her flush with pleasure.
"You think so?"
His eyes lingered on her lips as he pulled her forward and kissed her deeply.
"Come on,"
she said, when they pulled apart.
"I have a surprise for you."
She led him by the hand into the house.
"Okay, it's not much of a surprise," she admitted.
"Oh, it smells great in here."
"That's the surprise."
"Did you cook?"
She laughed.
"No, but I did make a stop at Eatsy's. I bought a bottle of wine and dessert. I'm splurging tonight."
"What's the occasion?"
She felt her smile freeze on her face. "What's the occasion?" Her stomach dropped a bit. She was making too big a deal of all this. She turned away from him, smile stuck on her face so it wouldn't crumble into little pieces around her feet, and opened the cabinet to retrieve the wine glasses. She pulled the second one down and felt his arms go around her waist. He put his chin on her shoulder.
"I was joking, Ellie."
"Did you get my message?"
Her voice was high. She grimaced.
"I did."
"I'm sorry about that. I ramble. I hope you got bored and cut it off before the end."
He turned her around.
"And miss hearing that you missed me? Not a chance. Hearing your whiskey-soaked voice was the best part of my day."
"Whiskey-soaked voice?"
She melted a little inside, though she couldn't help but think the description, in relation to her, was absurd.
"Jack, you're an amazing balm for my fragile ego."
"Everything I say is true."
"It's enough right now that you think so. But I dread the day when you see me, warts and all. Do you want some wine?"
"In a minute."
His hands were on the counter on either side of her. He was searching her face as though trying to memorize it.
"What's wrong?"
"I need to tell you something."
"Uh-oh."
"Two things, actually."
Her stomach dropped again. Soon it would be on the floor. Whatever the news was, it wasn't good. She remembered their first night together. The warning that this wouldn't last, fluttering through her mind as they made love, that she felt too much and it would destroy her.
God, she hated it when she was right.
She held his gaze.
"Just get it over with."
He took a deep breath.
"First,
A wavering smile broke across his face, and he blushed a little.
I love you.
She stared at him, uncomprehendingly.
What the hell?
He couldn't be serious. He was about to say he was joking. But if it was a joke, what an asshole. His eyes, though, gave him away. She didn't realize she was holding her breath until his name came out as a sigh.
Jack, you can't be serious.
I am.
But we've known each other for a week. How can you possibly
know? I've known since I shook your hand in front of Jay Maxwell's office.
Oh, that's crazy.
You're right. It is crazy. But that doesn't make it any less true. He put his fingers over her mouth to silence what she was about to say. I love you. I need you to know that, to believe it. Do you believe me? She had learned long ago that the eyes don't lie. The mouth can say anything. Body language can be controlled or faked, but masking what you really felt in your eyes was almost impossible. Jack's eyes were desperate for her to believe. She steeled herself for whatever else was coming.
Yes, she said,
more to move him on than because she truly believed him. The idea was preposterous.
What's the second thing, Jack?
Julie's back.
He said it quickly, like if he didn't get it out, he would never find the courage. A glimmer of relief showed in his eyes.
Who?
Ethan's mother.
Ellie's spine stiffened. She stood straighter, leaned back from him slightly, but he still had her pinned against the counter. That was why he said he loved her. Not because he wanted to or because he felt it, but because he felt he had to appease her before dropping the bomb into the middle of her heart.
Your wife.
Soon to be ex-wife. This doesn't change anything.
It changes everything.
Why?
Because you're married.
I was married when I was in your bed this morning.
Her voice rose.
But your wife wasn't sleeping in my house down the road, was she?
She pushed against his chest.
Would you please let me go?
Jack stepped away from her. She turned, poured two glasses of wine, handed one to Jack, and walked out the back door, wine bottle in hand. She was seated in an Adirondack chair when Jack came out a minute later. She sipped her wine, a 2009 cake bread Cabernet. She had splurged. She had it once at dinner on one of her trips to Dallas and loved it. Now, here, the bitterness choked her. Jack stood next to the empty chair. She looked up at him.
Are you superstitious, Jack?
No.
You see?
She pointed the finger of the hand holding the wine glass at him.
I didn't know that about you. There's a lot we don't know about each other, isn't there? Like your favorite music. I bet you like 80s hair bands. Am I right?
He nodded. I'm a country music fan myself. Mostly classics. Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn, Hank Williams.
Did you guess that when you profiled me? You did profile me when we first met, didn't you?
She sipped her wine again.
I can imagine what was going through your mind. Middle-aged woman, probably a spinster or unhappily married, easily manipulated by men, insecure, well-liked, but it's more pity-based than due to any redeeming quality of her own.
You're wrong, please.
I know me much better than you do.
She leaned her head back to take in the house behind her.
This house is cursed. My mom was driving home from this house when she drove into a tree. She did it on purpose, by the way.
She took another sip. It tasted better. With the hand holding her wine glass, she pointed to the lake.
Summer 1985, one of my best friends blew her brains out in front of me on that dock.
Jesus.
My dad died here, too, last year. He didn't kill himself, though. He was too big of a coward. I wish he hadn't been. Would have put us both out of our misery years ago.
Ellie.
And now this. I admit it's a little melodramatic, lumping the end of an affair with three deaths, but it is a death in its own way.
Jack put his untouched wine on the railing and crouched in front of her. She couldn't see him through the tears pooling in her eyes. "Ellie, listen to me. Look at me." She blinked, and the tears fell down her cheeks. Jack wiped them away with his thumbs. "I love you." She shook her head and looked away. "Ridiculous." He grabbed her shoulders and shook her. "I love you. I didn't just tell you that to soften the blow or to manipulate you. I told you that because it's true. You know what I thought when I met you? Huh? I felt sorry for all those dumb bastards who ignored you in bars, who looked past you to your friend. I saw in you what none of those idiots saw. The inner spark. You're beautiful inside and out." "I'm really not." "I believe you are. I will always believe that. I love you. I want to be with you. Julie coming back changes nothing. You and I will be together. I'm going to fight like hell to make it happen. I'm still meeting with Bob tomorrow and putting the divorce into motion." She smiled. He had that look in his eyes again, like he was ready to kick some ass.
"You can't."
"Watch me."
"Jack."
She took a deep breath. She was over her pity party. For now. She would have another one when he was gone. A good long one. Right now, she had to be the strong one. The logical one.
"Your position here in town is too tenuous for you to be divorcing your wife within a week."
He stood.
"Fuck Stillwater. People need to mind their own goddamn business."
He turned his back and stared at the water. They were silent for a few minutes. Ellie sipped her wine and considered what to do. She could let Jack do what he wanted, be the other woman, the one who destroyed a man's marriage. It would be a feeding frenzy of gossip, especially with her history. The cheated becoming a cheater, a homewrecker, pulling apart a family and, in all likelihood, destroying Jack's relationship with his son. She would have Jack, but would they be happy? She stood and moved next to him.
"Do you want to be with me?"
He turned his head to face her.
"More than anything."
"Then you cancel your appointment with Bob and try to make it work.
But
you have to at least seem to try. For Ethan's sake."
Jack looked back at the lake.
"He will never forgive you if you don't. And he will always resent me. He might anyway. Has he told her about us?"
"I don't think so."
"But he might."
It wasn't a question.
"I have enough on Julie to get a divorce granted and full custody."
"Good. You'll use it. Eventually."
He turned to face her fully.
"What are you saying? You want me to go back and live with that woman? Sleep in the same bed as her?"
"No. The thought of it makes me want to vomit."
"But you have to."
Jack grimaced.
"How long do I have to fake my marriage for Stillwater to accept us?"
He waved his hand in the air.
"Eventually."
"Until the new year."
"You're out of your fucking mind."
"So what? You're going to destroy Ethan's dream of having his family back together just in time for the holidays?"
"Why are you being so goddamn logical?"
He grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her again.
"Don't you care about me enough to fight for me?"
"You have no idea how much I care. I have no idea. Jack, think about it. You've come in here, and in less than a week you've turned my world completely upside down."
She closed her eyes.
"You tell me you love me,"
she said, opening her eyes.
"Then this. I know it isn't your fault. I'm not blaming you. God knows I could have stopped this before it ran away with us, but I didn't. But you can't expect me to ruin my reputation by destroying your marriage. I've worked too hard to build it back up. Even now, people don't mention me without either mentioning my father, my mother's death, Jinx, or the championship."
"Championship?"
She waved it away. There would be time enough for him to learn about that scandal.
"This town is brutal to women who stray from the straight and narrow. Look at Claire Dodsworth. 50 years later, and what do people remember? That she was a slut.
This isn't even close to the same thing. We care about each other.
He paced up and down the deck, running his hands through his hair. He stopped.
The beginning of the year? You're asking too much.
Do you want to be with me?
I do.
That means living in Stillwater. You know that, right?
He paused. She smiled. So, he didn't realize that.
I have no intention of leaving Stillwater. My life is here. My roots are here. Despite all of its problems and blemishes, I love the people, this town. Maybe if I can redeem this town, I can redeem myself.
You don't need to be redeemed.
A boat sped across the lake, much too fast.
You don't know everything about me, Jack. You can feel for me deeply. Maybe love me,
she said, turning back to him.
But don't assume you know everything about me.
She continued.
If we're going to be together, and based on the expression on your face, that's a big if, then we have to tread lightly with your marriage, your divorce, and our relationship.
He put his hands in his pockets.
Okay. What do we have to do?
Ellie raised her eyebrows, surprised.
What? Were you trying to scare me off? You're going to have to do a lot more than threaten me with living in Stillwater for the rest of my life, or imply that you have some deep, dark secret. I don't care where we live, and I believe in you. I believe in what I feel for you. I'll do whatever I have to do. Say the word, and I'll do it. Even live with a woman I hate for 4 months.
He stood with his feet apart, his shoulders square and back, his chin lifted ever so slightly. His eyes burned with determination and resolve. Somewhere beneath the fear and grief that threatened to overtake her, Ellie felt a glimmer of something close to faith.
You really do love me.
That's what I've been trying to tell you.
She felt the smile break slowly across her face.
Show me.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Stillwater, a Jack McBride mystery, written by Melissa Lenhart, narrated by William Dufresne. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright, 2015 by Melissa Lenhart. Production copyright, 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.